This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Dustin Campbell, Principal Software Engineer on .NET Languages at Microsoft. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening to join me, Dustin.
Thank you. I appreciate it. This is not a problem for me to be here.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about what you do and who you are?
What do I do? Well, at Microsoft, I work on the C# language design team. If you've watched the last few years at Build, you've seen that Mads Torgersen and I have done a talk called "The Future of C#," where there's Mads up there, and then everybody. The kind of the running joke internally is that I'm just the other guy who's up there with him, kind of his funny man next to his straight man. I focus on tooling here, usually on .NET languages. So for the last, fifth of my life, I worked on Project Roslyn from its inception, and my focus there was on the IDE and getting things like C# IntelliSense working again, and bringing in refactoring and all of this kind of code analysis frameworks and things like that we have built into Roslyn that are starting to kind of come to fruition in Visual Studio. You see more of it in Visual Studio 2017 and more of it with every update. And so I've been working on that for a number of years. And recently, in the last couple of years, I've been focused very heavily on cross-platform C# editing experience. My goal there is to make sure that C# is, when you pick up an editor with C# code, that your expectations are met, right? Because you get this very Rolls-Royce experience in Visual Studio where the IntelliSense is just exactly so. And I want to make sure that when you pick up any editor on any platform, that it's the same, that you get a great experience. And so I am the engineer working on C# for Visual Studio Code. So I build that extension, which is like, I don't know, it's like the second most popular next to like Python or something. Before that, I mean, I've worked on Visual Basic. I was an F# user and a C# MVP before joining Microsoft. So I've been in this space for a long, long time, I guess.
I've noticed on Twitter, your avatar is you playing a guitar. What's the story there?
I did not go to school for this, it turns out. When I went to university, I studied jazz guitar performance. I have a jazz guitar performance degree. I'm very much a rock guitar guy as well, but that's my what I studied and what I got papers for. It's kind of proof that Microsoft will pretty much just take anybody, I guess. I'd been a programmer for a number of years, and I learned C# because I got a call from a very good friend named Mark Miller, who is moving his product CodeRush from Borland's Delphi to Visual Studio and C#. And so he called me out of the blue and was like, "Hey, man, I'm selling my company to Developer Express, and would you come and help me build this thing out?" And so I actually worked for Dev Express for a number of years and got very I got a lot of exposure to Visual Studio and the Visual Studio team. And eventually, about 5 years later, I moved out here to Washington and started working for Microsoft. That was about 9 years ago now. So
tonight, we're going to talk mostly about C# 7 and kind of the future, maybe C# 8 a little bit. So the biggest thing that I think would be acknowledged by people in software was that the move to an incremental release. We used to have, C# 5, C# 6, C# 7, but now it's 7.0 and there's going to be a 7.1. Why the change to incremental releases?
Well, to infuriate all of you, I think, was the primary. No, that's actually, with my tongue firmly in my cheek, I'll say that we're just getting back to having incremental releases, because after C# 1.0, there was actually a C# 1.2 that is forgotten, but that had a few small features, and we declared C# 1.2. I think it aligned with .NET Framework 1.1 at the time. We've had them in the past, as my tongue in my cheek, but this time it's more about we recognize that there's a number of reasons to do big features. And when we do these big bang releases, we're kind of looking at like, okay, well, there's these bigger features and they take up a lot of time. But there's a lot of little pieces of value that we'd like to get out more regularly. Sometimes incremental releases are also not just about language features. Of course, they're about bug fixes and getting things out, right? Sometimes we've actually kind of changed a little bit of our strategy around saying how serious a breaking change is, right? Because we know that there's going to be an incremental release soon. So if it's something that's fairly, you know, constrained, something that's an edge case, sort of off in the weeds, that as a breaking change, you know, if we made a change here, this would break existing code. We know that if we do an incremental release, for example, we know that there's a release coming. Well, there can't be that much code for a feature we just released, right? So maybe we can still continue to tweak and iterate on things. One of the things that's been really helpful is having rebuilt the compilers and the IDE stacks completely, in a way that allows us to innovate there, has been really helpful in allowing us to think about doing a more rapid evolution of the language. We've also looked to some of our friends like over in TypeScript, and TypeScript has gone from 1.1 to 2.4 in an amazing amount of time with incremental releases. And they've been very successful with it. So I think we just kind of want to put our foot in the water and see if we can get this to work. Our first incremental release is C# 7.1. It's technically not out there yet because this update 3 of Visual Studio 2017 is not RTM'd yet. We're still in preview mode, and so I think I don't remember how many previews we've released at this point. It's been a lot. And with every one, we're continuing to tweak on this thing that's C# 7.1, and it's been kind of our first attempt at doing an incremental version of the language, and it's working out pretty well. I mean, in this particular instance for C# 7.1, it's about little features that make existing features nicer, just marginally nicer, but enough that it really feels good. You know, being able to make a main method async, for example, is something that has driven people batty for a while. We managed to get that done. We got in there our inferred tuple member names. So if you can imagine creating a tuple where I'm passing in the variables x and y, and I want them to have the names x and y, in 7.1 you have to say in your tuple literal x colon x comma y colon y. You have to give them the same names. Well, in C# 7.1, why can't I just say x comma y? Because the variables already have those names. And so that's, for example, it's just a simple little feature that makes that much, much better. And so that's the sort of thing we're doing in C# 7.1, just little tiny features that make life better. Now, we're looking ahead right now to a C# 7.2. And that is kind of around, and we're trying to think about themes and kind of a set of features that kind of makes good cohesive sense together. And there's kind of a really an ask from some partner teams, from some of the ecosystem, like the Unity guys, for some safe constructs, language features that you could do some higher performance sort of activities, but do them safely, right? And so there are some features coming that we're looking at for those, and those are still kind of being sorted out what they're going to look like. But the good news is, as we do these incremental releases, it all shows up on GitHub, right? So we created not that long ago, we created a new repo for doing C# language design called C# Lang, github.com/.NET/C#Lang. And that that's, you can see exactly where we're at with various designs of the language. And then, of course, the Roslyn repo, you can see exactly when things go in and what branches they're in and what state things are in. So it's kind of an exciting time, I think. I don't think we would have been able to do incremental releases without having our engineering at a point where we could really go and move much more rapidly and also get feedback very quickly. So the C#, another thing that kind of related to this question is the point of getting feedback. And that's, I'd mentioned that this is going into the next the update 3 of Visual Studio 2017, well, that update has had multiple previews, and we've gotten feedback and made changes and made tweaks as we've gotten feedback from people trying it out. And so that's been also super helpful.
So it sounds like you've had to make internal changes to your organization, change how you get feedback, change how you maybe do development as you move along. But are there infrastructural changes you have to make to the compiler, to the Visual Studio, to your deployments, to anything of that nature?
So not precisely. There, yes and no. There as we built Roslyn, we always had a kind of a vision or a desire on our own team to because we were coming from this horrible C++ code base where you would like build out the compiler, build out the IDE, and you copy binaries over your existing Visual Studio that was installed in the box and hope things worked, and then, you know, tried them out. It was just nasty. And so we're getting into a place now with Visual Studio, especially Visual Studio's extensibility model, that today when we work on Roslyn, on the Roslyn solution file, which includes the compilers and the whole stack up through the IDE, when we do that, we can make changes and F5 that into another instance of Visual Studio, right? And so and with the current extensibility mechanisms that are inside VS. So we get into a place where we're able to rapidly work on this stuff. And because that extensibility mechanism is there, we can also deploy those things much more easily, right? Roslyn itself is literally a Visual Studio extension, right? And that extension includes the compilers. It includes the expression evaluators for the debugger. It includes the IDEs. It includes the interactive window. And all these various components all sit in this Visual Studio extension. And it's funny, I'm looking at it right now. We have a lot of stuff up on MyGet, kind of nightly builds and that sort of thing, at .net.myget.org. And if you go to like gallery Roslyn, the Roslyn gallery that's inside there, you'll see that we actually have Visual Studio extensions. They're called V6s, VSIX files, posted there right now that like you can download and install into Visual Studio. And it comes with the new compiler, it comes with the, you know, editors. It can be scary, but, you know, because you're like literally putting new bits on. But the Visual Studio's extensibility mechanism allows you to hopefully uninstall these cleanly. There are some issues with that, so I'm not going to recommend it for the faint of heart. But we're working towards that. Another thing that's happened with Visual Studio is the new installer with Visual Studio, the new kind of lightweight installation. The critical piece there for us is thinking about how you can have side-by-side releases. So you can have your RTM, rock-solid Visual Studio, and you can have a preview version next to it sitting side-by-side, and we can introduce other channels for being able to deploy these sorts of things. And so that's also been is – I guess it's the sort of thing where we don't exactly have – everything, kind of the whole pipeline of how you might get some of this stuff, but we have it, all the pieces there. And so we're trying to plug them together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. But it sounds like C# is still tied to Visual Studio releases. So 2017 came out with C# 7, and you're going for 2017, let's say update 3 will have 7.1. Am I right about that, or is that inaccurate?
No, that's accurate. They are tied to Visual Studio releases in the update model, mostly because, you know, we're putting in these brand new systems, right? These entire systems, like in the IDE, for example. And if other things on Visual Studio want to build on those things, I'm not talking about the language. I'm talking about everything that relies upon the language being there. Then, you know, things kind of need to update at once. You could technically take this and install it on an earlier version of Visual Studio. The problem then is that some of these things require newer APIs as part of Visual Studio for some of the new features in the editor, right? Some of the things that we've been working on are things like when we did the new in Visual Studio 2017, there's a new find all references window, right? That actually has a whole new API to interact with, and that became challenging to be able to get Roslyn so that you could use one of these builds from a Visual Studio extension in both Visual Studio 2015 and in 2017, because there's this new API to take advantage of. So sometimes it's more of making sure the APIs are locked and Visual Studio is at a stable place. And that's just a great place to introduce a new version of the language, because we want people to be able to use those on a stable system. Now, you can always go grab it. These things are available. The compiler itself is available on NuGet. There's the Microsoft compilers, Microsoft.NET compilers package, I think it's called, that includes, the latest one went up 2 weeks ago. There are, this includes both the C#, the VB compilers. It includes the C# interactive command line executable. So it includes the compilers themselves. So you can write. Now, you want to get the entire tooling stack to go with those, but you can actually grab C# via NuGet today.
Actually, that was going to be my next question. Do you see a time when you can get the whole of C#, let's say 7.3, as a NuGet package or a set of NuGet packages?
What do you mean by the whole of C#?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I mean, getting the compilers or getting the Roslyn libraries, absolutely. Those have been there since we released those but on NuGet. But it's more of the idea of getting the entire stack where you're like, because it's one thing to say I've got 7.3, it's another thing to not get squiggles in my editor and get IntelliSense to work on 7.3, for example. So in that case, we're looking at these channel mechanisms that are built into Visual Studio with a new installer, so that you can, you know, we can deploy or also being able to deploy an extension that knows how to automatically update. So if you want to stay on the latest and greatest, you can, and then, you know, throw it away maybe when the next update to Visual Studio comes. Because right now, if you're in a Visual Studio user and you actually notice the little notification at the top right corner, it's lit a lot right now. If you're on a preview build, it's almost like being on the fast insiders ring for Windows, where it's just updating, it seems like, every day. As we are fixing more and more, trying to make it more stable and fixing more crashes, doing our best to make it as good as possible before we actually ship the update for real. Another component that goes along with, or another feature that kind of goes along with shipping an incremental release, is the problem where you work on a team and you've got some crazy developer. It's usually a guy like me, right, who's like, okay, you know what? I don't care what the rest of you are doing. I'm updating to C# 7.1 right now. I'm going to install the update, and you guys can all, live with it. And then the guys that don't update Visual Studio now get errors, or it breaks the build, those sorts of things, and just by virtue of having the update installed. And so what we've decided to do with these incremental releases to avoid that is that when you install an update of Visual Studio, you don't actually get C# 7.1. It's still C# 7.0. And you can, if you start using a language feature that is 7.1, will offer, it'll squiggle in the editor. And we'll offer a light bulb with a fix to upgrade your project to 7.1. Okay, so you can say, I want to use C# 7.1 on this project, and we'll go and update your project to do that. And then that way you've stated your intent. It actually goes in a property in the project file and states your intent that, yes, we are actually updating to 7.1. So that crazy guy who wanted to do it, he wants to use the latest updates of Visual Studio. He doesn't accident, even if it's unintentional, he doesn't accidentally start using language features that the team isn't ready to use yet, because it's very likely that, you know, there'll be people in groups out there that say, well, we're going to standardize in C# 7.0, and then we'll think about this later when we get to 8.0. We don't want to be on the bleeding edge, and that's okay. So we're adding some features to alleviate some of that pain.
What do you think the release cadence will be like for 7.1, 2.3, and so on?
Well, expect 7.1 is going to happen soonish. I'm not sure what that looks like or exactly what that looks like, but it's because I know that the dates move for real. But as far as 7.2, sometime in the next, several months. I mean, we would like to try and do these in the kind of roughly 6 month period, but we're kind of beholden. You correctly assessed that. We're trying to make sure that we align with Visual Studio updates as a good kind of inflection point to introduce all this new surface area, both for the language and the APIs. So we're kind of beholden to when Visual Studio is. We have where we feel like we can do, right? Because we have to produce, a high quality language that's well designed. We have to produce all the tooling that goes along with it, and so there's a limit to how fast we can go in reality, but also, you know, then we're also beholden to kind of what Visual Studio's update schedule is going to be like for these. And then we're also, this is an uncomfortable topic a little bit internally, somewhat, but the idea that we might not get our point releases that we plan for, right? If there is no Visual Studio update, or Visual Studio says, hey, nope, we're going to do the next release of Visual Studio and here's where it's going to be, and we decide there'll be no more updates, or we just get too close to the next version of Visual Studio, we'll probably pull up and say, well, it's time to go work on 8.0. At this point, we're trying to do everything in parallel, where we've got some people working on the compiler team, working on new language features for 7.1, 7.2. And then we've got people that are working longer lead on 8.0, because 8.0 is, we're trying to target kind of these bigger sorts of more broadly reaching features that really change kind of the way you might code. And so we're trying to do it all in parallel, which means we're also doing the language design in parallel. The reality is that if we get too close to that 8.0, that Visual Studio next, whatever that is, then we'll probably have to pull up and say, okay, we got to put all hands on deck to get 8.0 done. Otherwise it's going to stink.
Oh, so while you have 2017, you'll be sticking with C# 7, and let's say there's Visual Studio 2019, you would jump to 8 at that point. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that on major releases of Visual Studio, and 2019 is who knows. Sure. I'm just suggesting that on major versions of Visual Studio, that seems like a great place to introduce new versions of the language from a major language feature standpoint. Because it's honestly, Visual Studio is a product that we like to sell and get people to buy. It is a major box feature, right, to say, okay, and here's the next major version of the language. And so aligning that with Visual Studio is not just helpful for us to be able to have a good place to ship it that's stable, but also it's good for Visual Studio in general.
How do you decide between things that, I know you're saying maybe it's the scope or the size, but what makes you decide between this will go into a 7.4 or a 7.5, or you know what, this is too big, it'll go into an 8?
Yeah, there's some kind of principles we have around that, and then ultimately you kind of fall back on a gut feel. Like, is it achievable? Right. Some of them might be a candidate for an 8.0, for example, might be things where the design space is extremely large and we just have to think through everything. One of the examples that we're looking at is nullable reference types, right? That we've for 8.0 as an 8.0 feature, and we talked about it at Build a little bit. We even showed a prototype of it. That's a first prototype. Actually, that's not the first prototype. That's the second prototype, and we've got another one in the works because the design space is so large on that. Like, how do we introduce this marvelous feature that helps you write fewer bugs without breaking your existing code? We don't want you to upgrade Visual Studio. I mean, like, it's kind of dissatisfying to update Visual Studio to the latest and greatest and then find that your project doesn't build anymore because there's all sorts of errors about, you know, this might be null and that might be null. And how do we do that in a way that makes sense? And also, there's this little thing called the halting problem that is kind of the problem of where we can't ever get it exactly right when we start looking around for null. And so how do we get the right amount of bang for the buck? How do we encode this into the language such that it makes the, it adds the most value to the user with the fewest detractors? That's kind of what we're looking for. And that's just a big space to think about. Now, in C# 7.1, some of them are just really obvious little features we should be doing. My favorite that's, I think, in C# 7.2 right now, I think, is one that just kind of came up recently. I'm not even 100% sure it's in C# 7.2. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to type and see if I can get to the C# lang site to see where it is. My good friend Jared Parsons is always updating this with what the latest and greatest features are. But one of them is the idea that To be able to have non-trailing, what is it called? Non-trailing named arguments is the name of the feature. I'm actually looking at the proposal right now. And this is, I don't know if you use named arguments in the language much, but it's the idea that, you know, I can put the name of the parameter and the colon in front of the value. The problem is with that is sometimes I want to, well, one of the great things is I can document things. Like, you know, when I'm just passing true or null or something like that to a parameter as an argument, I can document it and just put the name in there. But then the cost of that is that then I have to use named arguments all the way through the rest of the argument list, all the way to the very end. And so this feature is about allowing you, basically not impeding you in that way, so that if the name that you're putting in there is trailed by arguments where the you're passing in either you're passing in values that match the parameter names and things that, that you should that should be legal. You should be able to do that. And then but being able to say that that once you've named an argument and it's still in the same position and you don't swap positions around, you should be able to go ahead and you shouldn't be it shouldn't be caused to have to introduce names for the rest of the arguments in the list. And so that's a feature we're looking at, I think, for C# 7.2-ish timeframe, because it's just really, really nice. We talked about it in May. I'm just looking at the proposal that's on C# Lang on github.org /.net/githublang. There's a proposals feature folder in there, and in there are all the latest language proposals, which is pretty cool. And so that's I don't know where that one's going to land, but I'm kind of hoping it lands in C# 7.2. We'll see.
So that kind of gets me to another question.
Oh.
But it feels like C# is changing slowly. So, you know, whilst that is a very useful feature, it doesn't feel like it's something significantly different than we already have when you compare it to, let's say, .NET, where you went with Web API 1 to 2, a lot of things changed, like routing and a few other things. We go from Web API 2 to core, a bunch of more things changed, like even the iAction result versus the something else that came before, and I can't remember. But it feels
You're specifically talking about ASP.NET, which changes very rapidly.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Because that changes at a web speed, right?
Yeah. So why is there such a difference between ASP.NET, my Web API will change enormously from one version to another, and it feels like C# changes at a much, much slower pace?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. One, we've been asked not to to slow down because as Visual Studio started coming out every year or every 2 years, there was a new major version of the language. It was a lot for people to absorb. I mean, if you were working with C# back in 2.0, and then the amount of stuff we've introduced since then that were big ideas, right? You know, from link to dynamic to async, these kind of bigger things. People from a language perspective, I feel like C# actually evolved at a reasonable pace, not at breakneck speed like the ASP.NET API surface area does. If you look at the .NET framework surface area in general, that has actually evolved at a very, very slow pace as well. But from the language, I mean, there becomes a point with a language where we're not going to break previous versions of the language if we can help it, right? So everything we're doing is either, you know, additive or and complementary, and composes well with what you already have. We don't want to break existing programs, and that takes a lot of thought to keep from doing that. But also, languages, I really do believe that languages have kind of a conceptual lifetime where if you look at languages that have been around for many, many, many years, where the number of features and concepts that have been put into those languages over the years, that they're almost, you know, bursting at the seams or falling over, very difficult to approach as a new developer. I think of languages like C++ is one that gets a lot of kind of flack in this area as being very, very complex, more complex than it used to be even, and it just kind of gets the kitchen sink. Another language that people don't think about as much in this way, but is certainly true, and it's one that I've come to realize over the years working on it, is Visual Basic, where Visual Basic has a lot of legacy and a lot of kind of just tons and tons of features. When we went to re-implement Visual Basic for VisualBasic.net for Roslyn and rebuild it as well, there were features that we completely forgot about that were on our backlog. And we're like, oh, yes, it does that. We completely forgot. And we had to go adjust our backlog and adjust our date because we had nobody could remember everything it did. And so when we try and do languages, or C-sharp, because I would argue that C-sharp 7.0 is actually a fairly big release with things like tuples, pattern matching. But what we really try to do is take kind of the essence of those features. What are the things you need to be productive? Make sure that those features compose well with the rest of the language so that they don't feel like big new things. They just feel like the language just grew a little bit. You know what I mean? So, you know, your tuples, when you use them, they're just very naturally used in place with other things. Pattern matching, well, gosh, it just kind of extended the switch statement and the is expression, but it feels kind of small, but it's actually kind of a big deal. And so in a lot of ways, it's because we're evolving things and trying not to break everything behind it, then it can feel like it's evolving a little bit more slowly. I would argue that it's evolving faster than I remember it evolving years ago. So,
how do you balance, I'd say, features that might improve performance of the language or match something that might be in another language that's really popular against increasing complexity for us developers?
Oh, well, increasing complexity for developers is actually something we're super mindful of. And we are, you know, we're kind of, when we think about, especially when we think about things like performance features, this is kind of an interesting point, because often things that introduce performance mean that you kind of lose sometimes that level of abstraction, right? We were talking, a bunch of us were talking today about I was about an event I was at, Mads and I put on a couple of years ago called lang.next. We did it in San Francisco, and we had a bunch of language designers out, and we had Bjarne Strustrup, who does C++, and we have, you know, Dave Unger from Smalltalk, and a whole bunch of people, just a bunch of old kind of luminous guys. Rob Pike was there for Go, and it was a lot of fun. And there was this period where people were just asking questions, and somebody asked, well, how do I get the most performance? I want to get as fast as I can possibly get. I mean, how do you do that with your languages? They're like, well, you don't use our languages. You use C and you do arrays. That's what you do, right? And basically, and if you want to translate that in a way, that's you give up all of the abstraction of your language that makes you productive, and you get down to the basics, right? You get down to the primitives, the rudiments of what you need to do. There's only one thing faster than that, and that's let's go to, you know, the assembler, but now you're not portable anymore, right? So if you want to be portable, it's C plus arrays. So when we think about performance features, you're kind of as you increase performance, in a lot of times you're starting to reduce abstraction, right? Or take away abstractions from the language, so you can get at those core sort of primitives, those rudiments, get right at the memory, get things locked in place so that now you can scan over them with pointers to the memory itself, right? And those sorts of things. And so when we try and introduce those features, we also want to recognize, and this is the sort of thing we're careful of, we try to recognize that is not always for the masses, right? The masses, I think, would prefer to use a library that did some of those things under the hood for them and was efficient, right? So the idea that you use the Kestrel web server, to kind of continue with the web theme, and you want under the hood, you want that to be as efficient as possible and use whatever high performance constructs it can to be as fast as possible. But when you're being productive in the C-sharp language, you're not necessarily thinking about exactly those things, right? And so we're really careful about remembering that those audiences might be a little bit different, and that we've done this in the past. I mean, you think about unsafe code. Well, unsafe code, by definition, or just by its name, feels like something you shouldn't go do. It's unsafe. It's like, you know, don't take candy from this language feature. It's bad for you. But it's not. It's efficient, but you're going to have to. You might lose some productivity in doing that. You're gaining efficiency in the program, because That's how language abstraction works. Language abstraction necessarily puts layers on top. We try and be as efficient as we can, but it does put layers on top. You think about things like lambda expressions, which are generating potentially closure classes and capturing variables and all those sorts of things. And you know, I still like to use them because they're productive. Now, so the other part of that question you asked, which is about matching something.
Matching features from other languages.
In other languages,
people might complain that Rust has something that C# and C# doesn't have a matching feature.
Sure. And about increasing language complexity and that sort of thing, where there's people asking for features. That's something we've also been very mindful of, and what it might also, kind of contribute to the notion that we evolve slowly. Because often there are features that, like pattern matching that was introduced in C# 7.0, is something that people have been asking for since before I joined Microsoft, right? Since people became aware of languages like F#, they started programming in kind of a different style in F#, and they came over to C#, and they're like, well, where's my pattern matching? How can I even write code anymore? But that sort of feature can add a lot of complexity to the language. And tuples were another one where I was not on the C# language design team at the time, but I remember at the very end of Visual Studio 2010's release cycle, that was C# 4, where we did dynamic and named arguments and things like that. There was a prototype of tuples done. It was totally different than what we did. But there was, in fact, a prototype, and the language design team was talking about it back then. And so I remember with tuples and pattern matching in particular, we really struggled with complexity and trying to introduce these features that are conceptually heavy, because complexity can come in many forms in a language. It can come in forms of being just like, my code is obfuscated now, you know, that sort of complexity. And then there's the features where it just adds concepts, and the concepts, it becomes very concept heavy. And so what we want to do with these kinds of features is really get down to the essence of them. What makes them, what is the least we can do that would make people immediately productive? And what's the most we could do? And try and kind of find where's the sweet spot? Where's the right level of features? I think we got that with pattern matching. Because with pattern matching, and people will argue this because there's more we do want to do there. But with pattern matching, you know, we had a whole proposal that we were going through around really, really deep kinds of patterns and recursive patterns that go down and match properties and on objects and have it, you know, so you can patch any property on any object, or whether we add record types into the language so you can pattern match on those easier than any old object. Discussion about active patterns, which are another concept that F# uses. And we just had tons and tons of discussion on that sort of thing. And then I remember Mads and I went to Build, and we were in San Francisco, and we were at breakfast, and we're kind of a little dissatisfied about it. And so we just kind of every day we kept talking about, well, what's the right sweet spot for pattern matching? What can we do right now, and what's additive that we could go and do later as we kind of figure things out, right? And so this was last year's Build. We were in San Francisco. We also went to that Build, and we showed off tuples. I don't think we didn't show them actually in code. I think we showed them on slides. I can't recall. I don't know if we had a prototype of them yet, but we had a prototype. Sorry. But we came away from that Build with the knowledge that people were really excited about that feature. And so we tried to get to, again, what was the sweet spot? What are the things that people really, really need? We came back from Build and we said, look, this is what tuples need to be. This is, you know, I need to be, I put up three syntaxes on the whiteboard in the design meeting. I said, I need to be able to write var x comma y equals point, you know, with x and comma y in parentheses. I need to be able to write for each var x comma y in points, right? So that I can be able to for each over some collection and get back and decompose that tuple into x and y. And I need to be able to do from, and then in parentheses, x comma y in points. the last one we have not gotten to yet, but that was, you know, that was a difficulty. But the whole point of that was, that exercise was to say, let's make sure that when we do these language features, that yes, they're going to add a certain amount of complexity, especially a conceptual complexity, but if we can make them compose with the rest of the language, right? So that you can use them in all of these places where you normally are already writing this code, and then it's just a little bit nicer because you go, oh, well, I can use a tuple in there. Or with pattern matching, you know, I write my is expression, and I can name the variable that matches that type. You know, I say if O is int, and then I can give it a name I, and I can match that type int and pull out I, or likewise in a switch case. And we got to those constructs. There's a lot more we can do. We can do match expressions and recursive patterns, but we really wanted to get to the place where it felt right as far as like how productive you could be. Again, it's the sweet spot.
Do you think there are any more pattern types coming along, or other ways of using patterns in the language?
Absolutely. You know, all the stuff I alluded to, recursive patterns where you can recursively match an object and kind of decompose it down, pulling out values, you know, pulling out like property values. Say, well, if this property is 42, then pull out, you know, this text value here and put it in variable T. You know, your ability to kind of to decompose structures and match on them and pull out values and give them names. That is something we'd really like to do. We looked at that and we thought this is an additive thing. Once we get pattern matching at the core of pattern matching in the language, we can go do this. Right now, it is slated for a theoretical C# 7.3, but I don't know if that'll happen. So we don't have, you know, right now we're you know, full bore on getting C# 7.1 done. We're working hard on C# 7.2. And as far as that goes, the crystal ball doesn't show me if Visual Studio will have updates or when that release cadence will come to an end. So, but if there is a C# 7.3, that is high on the list.
What about shapes and extensions?
Oh, shapes and extensions. This is kind of an interesting thing, and it kind of goes to a little bit of what I've been talking about concepts and making a language too concept heavy, and trying just being mindful of that. There are some features from functional languages that a lot of people would like or ask for. I'm not sure if they like them or if they just see them and they go, yes, I need that. Or that's really interesting, I must have it. Or if they really have a use case in mind, sometimes I'm not sure. But we've had some guys over at MSR Cambridge, Microsoft Research in Cambridge, looking at adding type classes to C#, which is a feature that functional languages, especially popularized by the language Haskell, which is the idea that you can define an abstraction for your classes themselves, right? So I can have a class that defines the set of members that if you know that other classes can define. Now I can speak of them abstractly, and so the idea that like this is something that would be used for quality, where like, well, there's lots of classes that might have these members which can be used to define a quality or comparability on a type, and it's kind of an interesting concept. So they've been working on trying to figure out a way to introduce this into the language. And the difficult thing about it, at least with the approach they've taken, I've seen a lot of approaches to this over the years, different ideas, some of them quite crazy, some of them not crazy but inefficient. This one is really, really interesting, and its trick – And this is Mads actually wrote a document about this. It's on C# Lang repo. He wrote kind of an idea just kind of for people to discuss this idea. And he talks about this particular MSR research there. But we took that and were inspired by it. We also started thinking about the feature we call extension everything, which is some hypothetical feature someday where you can do more than just extension methods, but you could have extension properties, or you could have extension constructors. You know, I mean, there's the sky is the limit as far as that goes. And so we've had a prototype of that, just kind of the idea around that. It's a tricky business to get done. But Mads decided, well, let's what if I took that and this kind of type class idea, and we introduced, and again, it's just a hypothetical for discussion only, but it's getting some really cool traction on and discussion on the repo. But the idea is that, you know, you could define shapes in the language, and those would be sort of this kind of type class sort of way of doing things. And this is what I think is especially interesting about this is that it's a great way for us to engage with a larger C# community. And when we have these notions and ideas that we're, you know, it used to be that we would just send them around the C# language design team alias. Now we can put them up and just, you know, let's talk about them. So yeah, it's, if anybody's listening and wants to check it out, it's on C# Lang in the issues. It's number 164. It's on GitHub. The idea of, you know, being able to define a shape. And so you could think of a shape as sort of like a type class. Like, here's a shape that types might have, and this shape might have an operator plus on it and a property zero. And then from that shape, if a type has that shape, then you know that you can accumulate it, right? And you can add it all together. You can sum that type because it has a plus operator and it has a notion of what zero is. So, for example, is the example that he uses in the, I think he uses on the issue. So that's kind of the idea. I don't know if we'll get there. Right now, the big things on our plate for C# 8, the very, very big things, are the nullable reference types and default interface members, right? So the ability to, on an interface, give a member a default implementation so that you do not have to implement it. A key idea around this is I've gotten a lot of people asking questions like, well, why wouldn't I use an abstract class? And I've started, instead of calling them default interface members, I think I've been trying to give them a different name that kind of speaks more to how they might be used. I've been calling them optional interface members. The idea that, oh yes, I can have an interface, and here's some optional bits that you might implement if you care. Right. The example I used at build was if I had like an iLogger interface and I wanted to add a member to it, that I could now update that interface, add the member without breaking my clients, any clients that anybody who implemented that interface already, because there's a default implementation there. Now, but one of those specializations of that logger, there might be a console logger and it doesn't care, just do the default thing. But there might be a telemetry logger that says, well, now I need to connect to, you know, some backend thing and send information back home, for example, when you log. And so it might want to actually go and add an implementation for the feature, for the newly added member. So that's the idea. It kind of goes along with Java, default interface member implementation that was added in Java 9, but also protocols that are found in Objective-C and Swift, where you have optional members on interfaces. We want to that seems a useful thing, and it's a useful way to be able to extend an API and build on an interface without breaking people.
So here's a rather deliberately vague question.
Sure.
What do you see the future of the language?
The future of the language. I think the future of the language is, it's bright as far as we have ideas. Right now the language is, it's interesting that, you know, at Microsoft, we've kind of had this very focused, I would say myopic almost view of C# and the ecosystem that's built up around C#. And so it's always been kind of tied very, very strongly to the Windows platform, to .NET specifically, .NET framework. And so as C# moves around, whether it goes cross-platform, you can do all your development on a different system, but where the ecosystem that we really didn't recognize, things like Unity that we didn't recognize as probably as much as we could have until, you know, recently, more recent years, C# has a brighter future than us. It seems like it's going much further than we have the capability of taking it. I mean, there's more C# code running on PlayStation 4 today than I'm stunned at that. And we had almost nothing to do with it. Right. And so I think the language future is bright. I think it's brighter than it has been in a long time. I think it's really exciting.
About half the questions that I've asked you came from either listeners or people I know who have obviously an interest in the language. And here's one more, and I'm going to read it out as I got it.
Okay.
Do any of these C-sharp features help to improve Settlers of Catan skills?
So Skeet just sent it, huh? That was
he
John
did.
Skeet.
Yes, it was.
Well, he's calling me out because John knows that I'm not as good a Catan player as he is. And there, I will say it on a podcast for everybody to hear. It's captured forever. Yes, John has thrashed me soundly at Settlers of Catan for years now, whenever we see each other. So, but though he does cheat, I will say, so capture that on the podcast as well. The last time I think we played, we were at Google in London, and he brought the German version of the game, which none of us could read but him. So we're looking at the car going, is this a Year of Plenty? What is this? And he's like, well, sorry, I can read it. What's wrong with you? the versions of the language will not help Catan skills as I demonstrate clearly.
So before we wrap up, any final notes for tonight, Dustin?
I would say if you're interested in the C-sharp language and where we're headed, I would just say, you know, the C-sharp Lang repo on GitHub at github.com/.NET/C#Lang is a great place to get involved. That's where we're kind of making the future of the language. So that's all I've got.
Dustin Campbell, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Dream by Chan Wai Fat.